KPCW News Time is 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour. We're going to hear about our weather today, but unfortunately, it is time for Thomas Guiboy to fly, and this is his last time with us. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Roger. How are you doing today?
I am doing great. Let's do the weather, and then I want to hear a little bit about where you're going.
Okay. Well, we'll get you up to date with the forecast then. It's going to be a really pretty day across the Wasatch Back. We have high pressure that's building in over the next several days. We'll see a couple of systems try to undercut the high pressure, and that'll lead to our temperatures kind of going up and down a little bit from the end of this week through the first half of next week. But for today, we'll check in with mostly sunny skies. That daytime high in Park City should come in right around 70 degrees, which is pretty close to where we should be for this time of year, as the average high is right around 68 degrees for this afternoon. Then tonight, it's mostly clear. Overnight lows head for the mid and upper 40s throughout the Wasatch Back. And then for our Saturday, the first of those few weak systems will work their way in. So by tomorrow afternoon, there will be at least a slight 20% chance for an isolated shower or thunderstorm. Otherwise, we'll continue to see mostly sunny skies with a daytime high that climbs to 76 degrees tomorrow in Park City, so decently a bit above average, while Heber tomorrow will likely see a daytime high climbs to right around 80 degrees. On Saturday night, it's back to partly cloudy skies, the overnight low dropping to 50 degrees. Then on Sunday, with the passage of the system on Saturday, we'll see the temperature ease down slightly to the low 70s once again as we check in with mostly sunny skies. Then by Monday, we're back into the upper 70s, all for another weak system to move in between Monday night and Tuesday. And between Monday night and Tuesday, a slight chance for a few showers as the daytime high on Tuesday briefly drops back into the upper 60s. And on Tuesday, we'll probably see a little bit more cloud coverage than what we're going to see most of the next few days under partly sunny skies. But the main thing that we're watching for is by the middle and second half of next week, forecast models still very optimistic that we are going to see a very strong ridge of high pressure set up shop by the second half of next week. So by Wednesday, we're back to mostly sunny skies, a daytime high of 76. Then as we look to close out next week with a straight southerly flow thanks to the influence of the high pressure, daytime highs in Park City could very easily see the first 80s of this year, mainly meaning that we're going to be looking at it likely a summer preview by the end of next week. And really, as we move into the second week of June, it looks like our temperatures will be staying well above average, Roger.
Okay, Thomas. So, Thomas, I know you talked a little with Leslie yesterday about what's going on with you. Mm-hmm. Can you share it with for our audience who missed it? Where are you going and why?
So, I don't think it's a secret that I've always said that I'm from the Gulf Coast. And ultimately, the time has come to make a switch for me and my family. So we are going to be moving basically back home closer to family on the Gulf Coast. And home for me is the Mississippi Gulf Coast. But in my time before coming up here, I've spent time basically up and down the Gulf Coast from Louisiana to Mississippi to Alabama. So we're going to be moving back into that area. But Utah ultimately is going to always have a very special place in my family's heart because this is where we brought our daughter into the world. She'll always be from Utah, and I'm hoping that even as we don't have a permanent place here, we're going to be coming back often because, of course, I love to snowboard. I want to be able to teach my daughter how to snowboard or ski. So hopefully that means moving forward, I'll still be around. It just won't be on a permanent basis.
And at least you'll be able to give her a proper education by being able to take her to those home Mississippi State football games.
You got it. I mean, there's really nothing better than an SEC football game. But I also wanted to make sure that I said thank you to you. Thank you for being awesome. I've loved being able to talk with you, to do the weather, and to all the listeners at KPCW. Over the last 3 years, it's hard to believe that it's been 3 years. It's been an absolute pleasure to be able to do this every single day.
It has been. It has been for us as well. All right, Thomas, thanks, and bon voyage.
Appreciate it, and good luck with everything.
This is Roger Coleman. You're listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up, we're going to stay on the weather topic. We're going to be speaking with Lisa Verzella. She's with the National Weather Service about their search for new volunteers. Then I'm going to be speaking with David Porter. This is an interesting topic. He's a spokesman for the Utah Symphony about the future of Abravanel Hall. We're going to finish our hour with an interview that Parker Malatesta recorded with Salt Lake Tribune executive editor Lauren Gustis. Stay tuned. Heber City is in the midst of a years-long, multi-million-dollar process to replace its aging water and sewer infrastructure. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports residents can expect disruptions to water service and traffic patterns this summer.
Heber's water and sewer pipes are more than 70 years old in some sections, and the city has been working since 2022 to update the infrastructure. Now that warm weather has arrived, construction teams will be returning to Heber's streets to resume the project. The start date has not been finalized, but residents have been notified work could begin as early as Monday. Heber City Public Information Officer Ryan Bunnell says the city's engineering department is working to finalize plans with contractors and construction crews. He says he doesn't expect work to be delayed more than a few days, if at all, but the start date remains unclear.
Everybody has the same goal. We all want to move forward with it on time.
If any significant changes to the project need to be considered, the Heber City Council will need to give its approval. Its next meeting is Tuesday. The next phase of work is planned for both 400 North and 500 North, along with the intersecting roads east of Main Street. Workers will install new sewer, water, and pressurized irrigation lines and repave the roads. Residents in affected blocks may experience interruptions to water service while pipes are being replaced. Households will be alerted 1 or 2 days in advance, and outages typically last 4 to 8 hours at a time. Traffic will also be rerouted to 300 North and 500 East to avoid the construction zone. This stage of construction is scheduled from June through October. City leaders have previously estimated the water and sewer replacement project will cost as much as $80 million. 2 years ago, the City Council approved a $47 million bond to pay for the project, plus an additional $25 million in loans and state and federal grants. When asked about updated cost estimates and expenditures so far, Bunnell said he didn't know the specifics of the contracts. He says once the new contract is finalized, it will become public record. The city says the project is a top priority as pipe failures have increased in recent years. Details about the project and live updates on construction progress are available online. Visit kpcw.org to learn more. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
6 months after breaking ground on the new Salt Lake Bees ballpark in Daybreak last October, Miller Sports and Entertainment released new renderings giving sports fans a more detailed look at the venue. The Salt Lake Tribune reports the new ballpark will be called Daybreak Field at America First Square. It will have seats for 6,500 people with an additional 1,500 that can fit in a grass and picnic area, making the total capacity around 8,000. Thursday's announcement said fans will be able to enjoy locally inspired food from scratch kitchens, quick service stands, and grab-and-go markets using smart technology. And of course, the Bees team store will be in the ballpark's plaza. Plans for multiple alcohol-free family zones remain in the works. The Miller Group said the privately funded ballpark and plaza are on schedule for completion by opening day in the spring of 2025. Well, joining us now on the phone is Lisa Verzella with the Salt Lake City Office of the National Weather Service. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning. How's it going there?
It's going great. Thanks for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do for the Weather Service before we get into the specific reason for our chat today?
Yeah, absolutely. I manage a program called the Cooperative Weather Observer Program, and it consists of a whole network of volunteers, our office as well as all around the country. And we have automated and mostly manual weather equipment that we pass out to observers who are volunteers who take temperature and precipitation observations for us every single day for decades or sometimes over a century. In fact, yesterday we gave a couple of awards to some an institution and a family that has been doing it for 125 years for us.
Wow. And do you have any sense of how many of these volunteer stations there are around the country?
Well, in Utah alone, we have over 100, and across the nation, there's about between 8 and 9,000 observers taking weather observations for us.
And does this feed into your forecasting, or is it more like this is really for your more historical database?
It's kind of both. It's near real-time observations, so we get to verify the forecast that we make in the short term. And also, crucially, to track the long-term records, especially with these stations that have been around for over 100 years, like the Park City Station.
That's interesting. So tell us a little bit about the Park City Station.
Well, it was actually established in the late 1800s at a private residence, and it's moved around a few times. Initially, a lot of these stations were set up to gather precipitation and temperature for agriculture, ranching types of uses, and then as people, more and more people come into the community, it helps with just day-to-day life and just becomes a more integral part of society. And that's kind of the case in Park City. So the office moved around, or the station moved around, from private to actually the city marshal was taking observations at one point. I think that was back in like 1918, and then moved to a few more homes. And then kind of became under the purview of Utah Power and Light, and they had a really lengthy service. And they, for as long as they existed, they took observations every day, and they closed down for a little while, and the Park City Fire Station took it over in 1991. And all of these moves have been pretty close to each other, so the data is pretty consistent, and we're able to use it when it's that close to each other. And then the station was moved again to a private home, and then I think about 2008, an observer was no longer able to be found, so we closed it temporarily. And then we were able to open it up again with the help of the Park City Library staff in 2016.
And I'm visualizing, you know, these weather collections in the late 19th century. How would that information get fed into the Weather Service? Did they basically just mail it and you'd get it like a week later?
Exactly. That's the way it was done back in the day. And then there was also a phone-in system option a little bit later than that. So observers could phone in more kind of real-time information and then send their data in at the end of the month. And now we have everything pretty automated on computers, so they could take the data at their observation time, say 9 o'clock in the morning, and they just send it right in on the computer. It goes to our products, which go out to the news. We can incorporate it into our forecasts, and it's all done almost real-time.
Now, historically, what would you do to sort of maintain quality control? I mean, these are volunteers. Did you have any sense of how accurate the information you were getting was?
Yeah, absolutely. So before we come out, I do a really good review for what we expect in terms of quality and accuracy in measurements, and I'll make sure they're taking the data right. And comparing with surrounding sites is very, very helpful. You know, these days there's a few modern automated sites like those up on the ski areas. But one of our most consistent and accurate forecasters also lives there in the Snyderville Basin, Matt Linden. So he's a great person to quality control against as well. So there's every month, that's part of my job, is I do the data quality control for Park City and 100 other stations.
And I guess that you mentioned that there are automated stations. I guess I wonder what it is that the Weather Service sees as an advantage in not just using automated stations to do all of this. If it's just measuring, what is it measuring besides precipitation and temperature?
Well, for the co-op program, that's, those are the two main highlights, the temperature and precipitation, of course. When you get it in snow form, it's quite a bit of an art. It's an art measuring snow, especially around windy areas. We've got several observers up in Wyoming where it's almost ephemeral. It comes in and it blows or it melts, or, you know, southern Utah, same thing, comes in and it melts. So you really have to be kind of on the ball, and it's really amazing what these observers do in their home, and they can capture all this. But snow is probably the trickiest part. And it's extremely helpful, I think, to have, you know, boots on the ground and eyes and, you know, the human element of involvement in taking weather, so you're not just bringing in all of the automated data and you lose all of that human element. You might lose some accuracy of information, but again, you can always kind of check with the data quality control, and you can call the observers. I do inspections every year, and whenever something goes wrong or the observers have a question, I'll come up and check out the site.
So, you know, one of the things I find fascinating is the way this country is just this massive number of subcultures. And clearly there is a weather-obsessed subculture. How do you get your volunteers, and what incentives do they have? Are these people who are just really into weather?
Mostly, yes, they are. we were just talking about this yesterday with these families that have been doing it for over 100 years. You know, a lot of it was in the beginning, you know, they really needed the information for their crops, for farming and ranching. And then it became really a service or a duty. There's a very big culture of service, especially in the older generation. And that's been passed down from generation to generation. It's more difficult with today's folks who move around a lot more, but the system has become a little more electronic, and has, like, the temperature has a 30-day memory, so folks can go out of town and come back and use the memory. And precipitation, you could use some accumulated data, so it's not quite as daunting for folks that don't want to stick around every single day of the month.
Now, you mentioned that you have a 30-day memory. Do you supply the equipment for these volunteers?
Absolutely. Yep, we have calibrated, checked equipment. I come out to a particular site and we'll find a good location, something that works for you and for us. I'll install it, work with the observers, teach them how to measure, and then come back and do all the inspections. And it's a really good give and take between the observer and the Weather Service forecast.
Any other incentives for the volunteers other than, you know, being told they're doing a good job and performing a public service?
Bragging rights, for sure. A lot of people, a lot of folks like to say, hey, you know, I know exactly what the weather was today in my site. And also we have, you know, we have awards when folks have started doing it for 10 years or more. We start handing out length of service awards. When they get to 20 years, there's quite a big plaque and a jacket that you can be nominated for the second highest co-op award in the country, called the John Companius Home Award, which Matt Linden just won a few years ago. And then if you hold the home award for 5 years, you're nominated for the top award in the country, the Thomas Jefferson, and only 3 to 5 observers in the entire country earn that every year. And Utah has had a Jefferson winner each year of the past 4 years.
Okay, so the real reason I think you're here today is because we've got an issue here in Park City. What's going on and what do you need?
Well, so we do have a temperature equipment set up at the library, and librarians have been just fantastic about taking all of that information, measurements every single day. And we used to have the precipitation over there as well, but it's a little bit congested in the field there, where a lot of kids are doing their sledding in the winter, and it just wasn't the easiest for precip. So local came to us, Rip Griffiths, several years ago and said, hey, I can, you know, put it in my backyard. I live over there kind of near the library, and we talked to the city, and we were able to move it over there kind of near the ballpark in City Park. So we set up the station, and that was going pretty well. Unfortunately, Rip passed away a few years ago, and we've had a couple of folks from the community that have been volunteering, but they're no longer able to take observations. So we have a station set up there near the ballpark, and what we really need is someone to come out and take precipitation measurements for us. It's nice to do it daily, but specifically when there's events that happen, the rain in the summer and the snow in the winter.
And is the station still in somebody's backyard? Would they be able to access that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's technically on City Park property. It's this kitty corner from the ballpark up there, and behind what I think is called the Snow Lodge. Mm-hmm. I kind of forget the name of that little lodge back there. But yeah, it's public access. It's over there near the 7-Eleven. Anybody can come by, and if people are interested, I can hook them up with the measuring sticks and all of the instruction. And it'd be great to get a team of, say, 3 or 4 people, so you can kind of trade off. And then you can enter in the data in the computer, and everything is pretty slick.
Well, hopefully you've attracted some interest by our chat this morning. How can people find you and find out more about how to volunteer?
Yeah, that would be fantastic. You can go to www.weather.gov/SLC. is our main page, and I'm just going to give out my phone number right here on the radio.
Absolutely.
Okay.
If you choose to, hopefully you won't get any strange calls, but our audience is pretty unlikely to do that to you. Go ahead.
Yeah, no problem. I'm available 24/7, so reach out if you have any interest or you know folks that do. I mean, I'm sure everybody knows folks that walk around that park on a daily basis, so that would be great. I'm at 801-554-4135, and if you didn't catch that, I'll leave the number with your station there, and people can access it through you.
We will post it. Lisa, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
We'll be right back after this. The Park City School District will get almost $500,000 in federal funding to purchase electric school buses. KPCW's Christine Weller has some details.
The Park City School District was selected to receive $400,000 in federal rebate funding to buy 2 clean school buses. The money is from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's 2023 Clean School Bus Program rebate competition. The Biden administration said the federal program provides a total of $5 billion meant to transform U.S. school bus fleets. It said with more electric school buses, school districts will help reduce greenhouse gas emissions and save money. The program also had student health in mind, as diesel air pollution is linked to asthma and other health conditions. Park City School District Chief Operations Officer Mike Tanner said the district is excited at the opportunity to add electric buses to its fleet. Electric buses are just one part of the district's commitment to cut down on emissions.
We've made a commitment overall in our transportation fleet to provide a very clean fleet. And so right now, we don't have any of the old dirty diesels on site. The majority of our buses are very clean, low-emitting diesels that emit less than a regular passenger car in terms of exhaust gases.
Tanner said the funding won't cover the cost of two electric buses. Those can cost around $350,000. However, the district won't incur additional costs to purchase electric buses. The district adds around three buses to its fleet each year, as buses are on a 10-year rotation. Tanner said with the federal funding, two new electric buses will cost the district the same as buying two diesel buses. Tanner said the district will have more information about when they will receive the funds and when they must purchase the buses in the next few weeks. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, since the Smith Entertainment Group announced the acquisition of an NHL team to be named later, plans for a new arts and entertainment district have been floated. Plans that could have a direct impact on Abravanel Hall, home of the Utah Symphony. Here to talk about what changes to Abravanel might mean to the symphony is David Porter. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Okay, the Smith Group has made it clear that it wants to move quickly, but there's been a swirl of information over the last few weeks about what might or might not happen with the district in general and to Abravanel Hall in particular. Where do things stand as you understand it now?
Well, we have been heartened by recent statements by both Mayor Mendenhall and Mayor Wilson that they will preserve Abravanel Hall, or try to. However, there's still the other narrative happening. They still do have plans to tear down Abravanel Hall. And honestly, the plan to retain Abravanel Hall within SEG's district, we haven't actually seen that plan. So the only plan that we've seen is a plan essentially to build Abravanel Hall on top of buried convention center. That's the only plan that's been directly shared with the symphony. It's been stated by Mayor Wilson that she's looking for a plan B and C that would include the hall, but she has yet to create that plan.
So the point you just made, as of now, the only plan you've seen involves full demolition of the existing Abravanel Hall, is that correct?
That's correct. We haven't seen a plan for a new hall at all, mm-hmm. but Mayor Wilson has stated, I believe erroneously, that that's the cheapest plan.
Oh, the demolition is the cheapest
Correct.
Plan?
Correct.
What would it take to rebuild? I mean, look, I think many of us have had the experience of sitting in Abravanel Hall with its extraordinary acoustics and its beautiful setting. What would it take to build a building like that now? I find that an extraordinary statement.
Honestly, I do too. I appreciate what SEG and Mayor Wilson and the city are trying to do, and you know, change is good in a lot of ways, and I'm a Minnesota boy, so I love hockey, so I'm excited about that.
You betcha.
But building a great concert hall, and Abravanel Hall is a great concert hall, is more of an art than a science, and it's very expensive. So, for instance, even in 2001, I believe it was built, Disney Hall cost $274 million. That's over $500 million in 2027 dollars when they would likely rebuild. Every concert hall that's been built recently, Kansas City and Philadelphia, these are ones that are built after year 2000, Elbe Philharmonie in Hamburg, they were all cost between $500 or $450 and $1.2 billion in 2027 money. So when Mayor Wilson says that they're going to build a hall for $200 million, it seems unlikely.
And now I've also heard that $200 million figure as a potential cost just to renovate Abravanel. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because the renovation of Abravanel Hall, it's actually a lot of that cost, about 40% of that $200 million figure, I think it's actually somewhere around $216 million, is new build, so additions to the hall. And then others are plans to regrade the existing seating on the main floor so that it's not so steep. And there's a good reason for that, because they want to make more ADA seating, but I believe there's other options as well, so we could get more ADA access without potentially affecting the great acoustics and the enormous cost of regrading.
Now, as you understand it, under the existing plan, if they were going to demolish it, what would happen to the symphony? Would the plan be that they would not do that unless and until a new building was built? Or would we be looking at a situation where the symphony might be without a home for a year or two?
Yeah, that the thought has changed over time. Originally, I think they were going to consider building the symphony hall elsewhere. But now they state that they want it to stay in the same location. Mm-hmm. So they would have to tear down the hall first and rebuild. So just to give you an idea of how long it takes to build a hall, Abravanel Hall took 3 years to build. I think if the tax, the bond was passed by the voters of Salt Lake County to build it in 1975. And I think the first concert took place, I believe, in 1979. Disney Hall, it was slated to take 5 years to build. It ended up taking a total of 16. So you can see how long these projects can take. They're very complicated. It's not like building an Echo Center, which is a beautiful theater designed for Broadway, where you know, everything's amplified, so you just don't have to worry so much about the acoustics. And if I were to go into Echo Center and play my violin in the middle of the stage, it would sound depressingly puny. And if you hear me go and play in the middle of a Abravanel Hall, you might think, wow, that sounds pretty good. So, it's a big difference. You know, a Abravanel Hall is like a great instrument. And if any great violin maker can tell you, you can build a violin out of the best wood you've found and build it exactly like the last violin that sounded so good, and then you play it and it doesn't sound good at all. It's just a tricky business.
Sometimes it just works.
Right.
And sometimes I imagine that it takes a number of tweaks where the first time you try to make it, it doesn't work and you have to change things.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So let's go back to what would happen. If is there a plan? What would happen to the symphony during an interim period, if they had tore down Abravanel Hall and you hadn't built a new one yet?
Yeah, I didn't answer your question because we don't really know.
We don't know. Okay.
We've had a number of ideas thrown our way. Mm-hmm.
Is there an alternative venue in the area that you might be able to survive in for a year or two?
Well, the alternative venues are neither the same quality as Abravanel Hall or necessarily available. There's been talk of halls that have recently been built in like South Jordan, which are nice for what they were built for, but they're quite small. There's been mention of the Tabernacle where the symphony used to play, but I don't know if we actually have an official invitation from the church to do that. And they're very busy and they use that for their own means, of course. And also, honestly, it's not an ideal venue. It's a remarkable venue, but not for symphonies. So we don't know what would happen. And, you know, we would probably have to leave the hall for a period of time for them to do the renovations that they do need to do, like adding a sprinkler system. So that's a natural part. Perhaps we could go on a tour. Maybe we could visit more areas of Utah and use that time to really explore our underserved communities. I think that would be a wonderful opportunity.
So that's interesting. We talked about this, the renovation issue. I guess I wasn't sure that you would actually have to leave during the renovations or that they couldn't schedule the renovations around leaving a season intact for you.
Well, I think it's possible that we could do it that way. Mm-hmm. It just depends. I guess I should defer to someone who mm-hmm. has that kind of experience, because I'm just a violinist.
You know, this is enormously complicated, and it's an issue that I think matters to a lot of people. Do you have a sense of who's actually going to make the decision and how that process is going to work?
I would say not exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that for people who may not be following this as closely as I am, just because it affects the arts community so personally. The way this works is there is a potential tax hike that's going to be passed by the Salt Lake City Council. And if they pass that, and I believe they will, then they have to decide on a participation agreement between SCG, which is the owner of the Jazz and what used to be the Coyotes, and the city, and they decide on things like zoning, what will be built, and what will happen with existing buildings. That's of many issues that they're negotiating. I think those are important ones. And what we don't know is how many of these have been negotiated already and are sort of set in stone, how many are still being negotiated, what kind of flexibility there is, and who kind of holds the power. But what's all the more complicated is that Salt Lake City doesn't own Abravanel Hall. Salt Lake County owns Abravanel Hall. So there's this third very important player, also owns the convention center and the land on which SCG will build this new development. So Salt Lake City has an important component, but so does Salt Lake County.
Okay, if listeners are concerned, well, before I get to that, let me ask you this. Who else would be affected by an Abravanel Hall disruption other than the symphony? Are there other major arts groups that perform there?
Oh, absolutely. I have a daughter who plays violin. She played in Allstate. Allstate uses it. Countless youth orchestras use it. There's speaker series that comes in. There's visiting choirs. There's Allstate Choir. There's bands, you know, the list goes on and on. Lots of graduations happen there. I had a great time because I'm always worried as a classical violinist in my 50s, am I just way out of touch? So I sat the other day and I just read through Google reviews of Abravanel Hall, and it was remarkable how much people love this place and the effect it has on them when they come in it for the first time and how much they appreciate going to something that's just so transcendently beautiful. And you hear that just over and over again. Wow, why did I never come here before? This is beautiful. And the most common comment was, there's not a bad seat in the house. Just over and over again.
It is an extraordinary facility. Okay, if people are interested in this issue and want to be supportive of the symphony, what should they do?
I think the best thing to do is to write your representatives. Write Mayor Wilson, write Mayor Mendenhall, write your city council. Write the symphony. Express support for the hall. If you really believe in saving that hall, say, hey, you save this hall, I'm gonna donate, not just to the symphony, but I'm going to donate to saving this great hall. Yeah, and just be vocal and write over and over again. I know it feels, I don't know, it feels like you're being a pain, but it's effective, and it's been effective. Sign the petition to save Abravanel Hall.
Okay, yeah. Before we go, I'm going to blindside you with a question about what the symphony's doing this summer. Do you have any sense of what concert schedules are coming up?
Well, we have a great chamber music series at Church of St. Mary, and then Deer Valley Music Festival up at is just always so much fun. And we have such a wide array of concerts coming up. So.
You know, you do sense when you go to the Deer Valley Music Festival that you guys are having an awful good time.
Oh, it's so much fun, and it's fun to see people sitting out there relaxing with family. It's a great opportunity for us performers to watch somewhat sometimes dancing, sometimes a little substance affected dancing, so that's quite entertaining for us. It's a beautiful venue. And you know, sometimes I'll be playing and I'll see a deer walking above everybody that they can't see. It's great. Yeah.
Okay, we've been speaking with David Porter, violinist with the Utah Symphony, about Abravanel Hall. David, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back after this. Summit County prosecutors filed felony gun charges Thursday against a fifth man they say participated in a shootout in Browns Canyon 2 weeks ago. KPCW's Connor Thomas has the update.
Summit County prosecutors say Avimelech Torialba of Lehigh was also involved in the shootout near Peoa, which erupted in the early morning hours of May 19th. He's the fifth man charged with five felony counts of discharging a firearm, two of those counts with injury. Court documents state nearly 50 rounds were fired and two people were injured at a party attended by hundreds at a rentable event space in Browns Canyon. Prosecutors say the shootout began as a dispute between party organizers and a group of men they'd kicked out of the event. Prosecutors have charged three alleged organizers, Manuel Pimentel Gonzalez and Francisco Romero Fuenmayor, both 23 and from Orem, and 22-year-old Alejandro Carreno Romero. Torrealba and another man, 18-year-old Jose Enrique Zuniga Diaz, were some of the men kicked out of the party, according to the charges. Charging documents state a group of men were kicked out shortly before 3 a.m. May 19th. They went to their cars and attempted to rejoin the party when organizers confronted them outside. In the ensuing shouting match, one man shoved another. Prosecutors say security footage shows the one who was shoved pulled a gun on the organizers, as did Torrealba. Then Pimentel Gonzalez allegedly retrieved a submachine gun from an SUV. Romero Fuenmayor exits that car, and prosecutors say footage shows the two men fired over the heads of Torrealba and Zuniga Diaz's group. That triggered the firefight, injuring Pimentel Gonzalez and at least one other person. He, Romero Fuenmayor, Carreno Romero, and Zuniga Diaz are being held in Summit County Jail without bond, pending a May 31st detention hearing. Pimentel Gonzalez has already waived a preliminary hearing and pleaded not guilty. Third District Court has issued a warrant for Torrealba's arrest. Charging documents indicate detectives have already searched his last known address in Lehi and found a 9mm Glock handgun magazine and an empty ammo box in the trash. Court records did not indicate Torrealba was in custody as of Thursday afternoon. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The Park City Chamber of Commerce and Visitors Bureau announced a new position today. Former two-term Park City Council member Becca Gerber will now serve as the Director of Community and Government Relations to help those most underrepresented in the community. Gerber was the youngest woman in Park City to successfully run and win a city council campaign in 36 years, and she spent the last 10 years as Director of Sales and Marketing for R&R Sports. Gerber is a graduate of the University of Utah and Leadership Park City 2013 class. She served as president of the Historic Park City Business Alliance from 2014 to 2015 and helped co-found the Wasatch Trails Alliance. Park City's Main Street has been torn up over the last 2 months for a waterline replacement project. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports construction is on schedule to finish before July.
Construction on Main Street began in May and has altered traffic during the weekdays. Park City is modernizing the water infrastructure in Old Town following a series of breaks in recent years due to the degrading condition of the existing pipes, which date back to 1984. Park City Public Utilities engineer Griffin Lloyd said crews are replacing the old iron pipes with PVC.
And the difference between the two for longevity is about 25 to 30 years. We estimated you'd get about 40 to 50 years out of ductile iron pipe, where PVC is rated right around 75 to 100. And then anything metallic that we put into the ground, bolts or fittings, fire hydrants, things of that nature, we're putting a anti-corrosion wax tape and wrapping the entire fitting in that. And that should get us some more longevity on anything that's metallic.
Lloyd said the final month of work involves tying fire lines to each individual building on the west side of Main Street.
The main line itself is done, and so we're just tying over the buildings to the new line. And then we'll take the old line out of service, and towards the end of the month, we will prep and pave all the trenches that we've excavated.
He said there haven't been any significant delays with construction despite the complexity of the project.
A lot of it is the unknowns in the ground. This infrastructure is all over 40 to 50 years old, so there's not a lot of great records on it. So when we're going and tying in these individual buildings, what we're seeing in the sidewalk is a lot different than what we anticipated.
Work will end in July, but construction crews will return to finish the rest of Main Street in spring 2025 and 2026. Parking in the China Bridge garage on nearby Sweet Alley is free for Main Street visitors until the end of June. The only exception is Park City Sunday Market and Savor the Summit, which is scheduled for June 22nd. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, once a month, we get to talk to Lauren Gustas, the executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, about what's going on in the state. We were able to record that interview yesterday. Parker Malatesta got to talk with Lauren. Here's that interview.
I'm KPCW's Parker Malatesta. On the phone with me is Lauren Gustas, the executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. How's it going today, Lauren?
Pretty busy, but that's every news day, right?
Totally. Well, we talk to you once a month to recap some of the top stories coming out of the Tribune newsroom. To start, this week, the Utah Attorney General's Office sued a reporter in your newsroom in a bid to prevent Attorney General Sean Reyes's official calendar from being released. Can you explain the background of all this?
Yeah, sure. So way back in the fall, which now seems like years ago, we reported on some of Sean Reyes's travel, which we were able to glean from campaign finance reports that he must file per state law. They are public records. And we found that he traveled to Texas and shot feral hogs out of a helicopter, and he traveled to Europe, and he was going to Vegas fairly often, all with support from donors, excuse me. And so we thought, gosh, well, wouldn't it be great if we could look at his calendar and see, you know, how much time he's spending in Utah, how much time he's spending on the road. And we requested, reporter Jessica Miller requested that calendar. She wasn't the only one. A reporter named Annie Knox from KSL Radio also requested Sean Reyes's calendar. And essentially the State Records Committee, which decides whether records that are in question are public or not, ruled in both cases that these records, that these calendars should be made available to the public. Well, the AG's office did not like that ruling, and so it has sued both Annie Knox and Jessica Miller to prevent release of those calendars. And so we were just sued this week. Ironically or not, it's the second time in 3 weeks that the Attorney General's office has sued us to prevent release of records, which is pretty remarkable, because there is a significant cost that comes with defending oneself in court and ensuring that, you know, the public has access to what the public should, which is documents that by law are available to it. And so I guess the question that I have beyond, you know, how long is this going to take us and what will it cost, is just what is in those calendars, Parker? What does he not want us to see?
Yeah, and so in these kind of situations, how does the Tribune go about defending itself and also the public access to these records?
Yeah, thanks. Unfortunately, because there was significant conversation about Sean Reyes's calendars, the state legislature in this last session ruled that calendars are no longer public, but it did not make the law retroactive. So we can still go through the process and work through the court system. We'll have to appear before a judge. We have good counsel down here in Salt Lake that is very passionate about the records that are available to the public and that, you know, the media regularly seeks. And so we'll work with them, and we're hopeful, but it will be at significant cost, and it will be months and months after, you know, we initially requested them. It may be that Sean Reyes is no longer in office by the time, you know, we are ultimately adjudicated by a judge.
Yeah, it'll be one to watch. Switching gears, arguably the biggest story in Salt Lake in recent weeks has been the proposed downtown entertainment district that would surround the Delta Center. This is being led by Smith Entertainment Group, with ties to Ryan and Ashley Smith, the owners of the Utah Jazz and Utah's new NHL team. They also have support from the state legislature. So where does this project stand on the local level now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. It's moving fast. That's the very short answer. It's moving at a rapid clip, and that's because there were several deadlines that were essentially identified during, again, the legislative session that we needed to hit if we were to reach, you know, ultimately the conclusion that most people wanted, which was the NHL to be in Salt Lake City. And so the city council has worked closely with the mayor, has worked closely with Smith Entertainment Group, has worked closely with stakeholders in the community. Those, for example, who are very interested in the future of Abravanel Hall, which sits potentially in this entertainment district and which needs upwards of $200 million in renovations in the years to come. So the question is, do we retrofit it? Do we fix it? Or do we raise it and start over? So lots and lots of questions. Some of them have been answered. Some of them have been navigated. There's another public hearing next month on the stadium, or excuse me, next month, next week on June 4th in front of the city council. We've heard lots of feedback from constituents. And then they'll move into a couple more meetings before a July vote. The Tribune did some reporting, Robert Gerke did. He looked at how much the proposed tax increase that would pay for this district will cost residents of Salt Lake City. And we figured out, and this is back in the napkin math, this is not precise, but we figured out that it would cost each Utah resident $221 over the course of 1 year in additional taxes to sponsor this district, if you will. But ultimately, I should add, it's a vote. The council will vote, and you know, there's very little chance that it will not be passed in July.
Okay, so as soon as July, we could get a vote on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the middle of all this, you know, cities have to do their normal annual budget process. A sticking point in Salt Lake City's budget this year is the proposed raise for Mayor Erin Mendenhall. So how large of a salary bump could she get, and why does City Hall say it's necessary?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure if it's the process or the number that was more concerning, at least to our readers. But we found out through, you know, just regular like due diligence and reporting that the mayor had put into, you know, this year's budget and packaged the conversation with the stadium conversation for a hearing earlier this month, a nearly $44,000 raise for herself. And that constitutes a 26% pay bump for her. It would put her in the neighborhood of $200,000 and change for an annual salary. Now, she is an active mayor. She is what we call a strong mayor, right? And so she's working day in and day out on behalf of Utahns and one of the most populous cities in the state. And just by way of comparison, we did this reporting, you know, her salary would be in alignment if the increase is passed with the salary of Park City city manager and Summit County's county manager. Now, I understand your cost of living is a little higher and you're probably paying more as a result. But when you look at the size of those cities or those counties and what the mayor is looking at, there is a significant difference. So a lot of chatter about whether she should be paid more or less and whether the city is sufficiently taking care of the people who work for it as it is taking care of itself. My, I guess, concern would be, have we been transparent enough about the process and have we had a good dialogue?
Yeah. Well, turning to Southern Utah, the Tribune's editorial board recently wrote about a fight involving a nearly extinct turtle and a highway. So what's going on down in Washington County?
Yeah, this is really interesting. Again, I think this is a process issue as much as it is what is the right thing to do. So there's these desert tortoises. They're endangered, near endangerment, near extinction. And the federal government has been trying to protect them for years. Literally, its efforts in this region date back to at least the 90s when locals accepted a deal to preserve 61,000 acres of public lands for that Mojave Desert tortoise and other endangered and threatened species in exchange for opening up some of the habitat for development. And St. George has grown. St. George is going to continue to grow. The county, Washington County, is somewhere 200,000 people and change. And when it's all said and done, probably not done, but 20 years from now, it's projected to be at 500,000 people. Lots of homes are going up down there. And there are fewer byways that are open, free, and clear and easy to traverse that county along. And so they're very interested in building a quicker pass over to I-15, to the freeway. Mm-hmm. And this proposed highway, which President Donald Trump approved kind of in his final hours of office after after many times being refused in previous administrations, it was refused in previous administrations. And so there's a whole, you know, now public process around hearings and people from Washington County being able to weigh in and say whether or not they want this freeway or whether they would like to preserve the desert tortoise habitat. And that period is open right now. So you could go make a comment and tell people how you felt about either that proposed byway or the desert tortoise habitat. But very interesting dynamic as you look at folks who have been there for a long time and understandably are frustrated by getting around, and then folks who are interested in preserving that tortoise habitat.
Yeah. Well, finally, the Trib recently did an analysis of home prices across the state as of March 2024. Just to name some numbers, Summit County has the highest median home sale price, no surprise, in the state at nearly $1.3 million. Wasatch County's second with a median sale price approaching $900,000. Houses in the Valley in Salt Lake, Utah, and Davis counties are closer, kind of hovering around $500K. So it's clear that an average person couldn't afford a home in the Wasatch Back. But what about the rest of the state? I know the report kind of looked at salaries and kind of compared what an average mortgage is.
So the average renter in Megan's story, Megan Banta did this story, she's our data reporter, cannot afford to buy here, right? They are about $100,000 short if we're talking just about the median price of a home in Utah, right? $100,000 short. But we did find that if you do want an affordable home in Utah, there is one place that you could go, and that is Beaver County, where the price of a mortgage, or the cost, excuse me, of a mortgage is $1,149. So there are still affordable places to live in Utah. However, they are fairly far afield. They are nowhere near either the Wasatch Back or the Wasatch Front, which is, I think, where most people would like to be.
Yeah, and just to remind our listeners, where is Beaver County? And is it seeing any growth?
That's a great question. No, it's adjacent to, or it abuts I-15. You pass by it on your way down to southern Utah. It's at least 2, if not 2.5 to 3 hours from here. So it's pretty much smack dab in the middle of the state. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, those are all the stories I wanted to touch on, Lorna. Is there anything else you want to mention?
No, I just say thanks to everybody who supports local news.
Yeah, well, thank you for your time. We've been speaking with Lauren Gustis, the executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. As always, for their stories, you can head to sltrib.com.
Well, coming up this Monday on Mountain Money, we're going to do something that, to best of my knowledge, we have never done before, which is we're going to have the author of a fiction book. Author Graham Moore is going to highlight a historical, it's a historical fiction book about a clandestine group within the U.S. Treasury Department charged with a top secret mission to crash the Nazi economy. Really interesting book that I've gotten to spend some time with. We'll be talking with him Monday morning. Then we're going to talk to Robert Spendlove, the senior economist with Zions Back, who's going to explain why, in his view, maintaining high mortgage rates is beneficial, especially here in Utah. All this and more on Mountain Money.